Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Our speaker this evening is Anna. Anna has been a member of Canando for many years, I believe about 7 years. Is that about right, Anna?
About 20, you're going to hear in the talk.
Wow. I don't know how I got confused about that.
Maybe the member book, but yeah.
And you're now living in the East Bay, is that right?
In Oakland.
You have been active now for some time in the Soto Zen Buddhist Association of America. Is that the right name exactly?
The Soto Zen Buddhist Association, yes.
Yes. And I think I remember from a previous talk that you gave that grew up in a household that left you somewhat more sort of harmonious with the idea of starting Zen practice than a lot of us who came from a more Western tradition. So that sounds really wonderful. Do you have a title for your talk tonight?
I don't.
The Nameless Talk. Well, thank you for being our speaker tonight, Anna.
Okay. Good evening, everybody. I first want to thank Les for inviting me to speak tonight. This wasn't the first time Les has invited me, but I'm really terrified of public speaking. So I finally said yes, and please be patient with me while I work through my nerves. So as Dave mentioned, I first came to Zen practice as a middle schooler. I found my dad's copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and it immediately resonated with me, even though I didn't quite understand it. At that age, I think I was 11 or 12. I wasn't quite raised in a Buddhist household in the way that a kid would go to a Dharma school and come to the Zen center with their family. In my family, it was more like, instead of your parents yelling after you to be safe, my parents would say, be mindful. And when I was young, there'd be groups of adults sitting silently in weird positions in our living room, and I would be told not to go in. So it was kind of a mystery. But once I found that book, my dad showed me the rest of his Zen library, which was really robust. And soon after, I started sitting Zazen. In high school, I would occasionally come by the old Canando Zendo. I found a lot of comfort in sitting in the dim light with others and in the teachings of impermanence and letting go of expectations and taking care of the things in front of me as they came, especially as a child in Palo Alto where I grew up. That was really welcome to me, all those ideas. Throughout my childhood, I struggled with the sense that I didn't quite fit. I had health challenges, almost daily migraines that were pretty debilitating and created a lot of stress in my life. Especially when I was younger, this often meant canceled plans. I'd sign up for a class or I'd make plans with a friend and I'd wake up with a migraine that kept me in a dark room for most of the day. The reality is that a lot of us have this in our life. We can get sick at any time, something that might be more present in our minds now during the pandemic. But in my life, I've had a daily reminder of impermanence without having to look very hard. I went to college away from the Bay Area in an area without a Zen center. So I would sit in my room, in my dorm room, sitting Zazen, and I would find a sense of guidance from books. When I moved back to Palo Alto, I was eager to join Canando and become an official member of the Sangha. I wanted to be with others dedicated to practice and get that sense of Sangha I'd read about. I really loved Wednesday night Dharma talks and early morning Zazen and going to coffee all together after, and it brought me a real sense of stability to my practice. Most of all, just spending that time with Sangha brought a lot of encouragement and inspiration. Especially when I'm experiencing pain or stress, I've noticed feelings of inadequacy, of uncertainty and anxiety. Connecting with others who are dedicated to living authentically and seeing possibilities through them has been really deeply helpful for me. I found joy and clarity in Sangha, and it's brought compassion to my own inner dialogue. Over the years, I've noticed changes in my patterns and in my practice. When I was in my 20s, I would often feel a sense of separation from my time in the Zendo and in my everyday life. The Zendo felt calm and right, and my everyday life could feel that way too, but it didn't feel like those things always connected. I would notice my mind telling a story or that I was chasing some type of excitement or accomplishment. And with time, I come back from those chases sooner and more often. Each time, I feel more of a sense of gratitude and curiosity than a sense of shame or self-criticism like I have before when I've noticed those patterns. Rather than being upset with my body for getting in the way of plans, I began to see my physical condition as one element of my experience. I know I can focus on being skillful in each experience rather than dwelling on my emotional reactions and my frustration. I've experienced much more peace in that mindset. Several years ago, I moved to the East Bay and wasn't able to come to Canando on such a regular basis. It was another chance to adjust and to create habits that match my values. I tried practice at other centers while coming back to Canando when I could. I started gardening and cooking more, and I began fostering dogs at the local shelter. I took a job at the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, which brought frequent opportunities for learning and a lot of inspiration. All of these things helped me feel more consistent in my practice. The pandemic has been another time of adjustment. Now working remotely for a Buddhist nonprofit, I spend a lot of time typing and talking about Soto Zen, just like reading about Soto Zen. Sometimes this can allow my mind to wander into stories. I can focus on creating support for other people's practice rather than my own. I've made adjustments by spending time with other types of meditation, spending more time in nature, and trying new schedules. As I reflect on where my practice is now, I feel many of the same things I have before. I'd like to sit more often, spend more time with my Sangha, and continue on creating wholesome habits. I'm really grateful for all the support I've received through my own path, and I really hope that with the positions I have and the opportunities I have, I can continue to help other people find this practice and be welcomed into it. At the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, they're working to help preserve and support Zen practice and expand its reach. And it's really exciting to be involved with so many people who are working towards that. I'm really thankful for Canando for creating a safe space for me as I've grown and worked in my practice. And I want others to experience that too. So that was quite short, but I'd like to stop there and open it up to questions. Yeah, Travis.
I think your parents were way ahead of the curve with the urge to be mindful. That seems like it's a lot more ever present now. I think they were ahead of the times, and you've been really helpful, you know, to me, like, as I've tried to navigate the Soto Zen Buddhist Association website, which, you know, it's like, it's kind of a, daunting thing for me, because there's a lot of like chat groups and like layers of it, I'm not sure how to dip my toe in it, you know. But I wanted to understand a little bit about like how you see your practice growing, you know, through, you know, the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, and like how working for a Buddhist nonprofit changes your perspective. You know, you grew up with, you're one of the rare, you know, Westerners to grow up with Buddhism. And I was wondering, like, now with that additional depth of having worked for SEBA, I'm wondering, you know, how do you see Buddhism growing in your own practice in, you know, the next 5 to 10 years and onward?
Yeah, thank you. One of my favorite things about this practice is hearing from others. And in my role at SCBA, I've gotten to hear about all different stories from people and how they came to practice and what they're doing in their lives. And I find that to be really inspiring. I get to travel around and see other Zen centers, which is wonderful. For my own life, I don't make really solid plans about that stuff. But I see so many possibilities now, having met so many people. I want to sit more. I'd like to go on more retreats. I love being exposed to all the different lineages that are present and learning about them. I really enjoy ritual. So it's wonderful to learn about how that continues in our communities. It's hard to answer about the future. And, you know, I spoke a little bit about having barriers with my health in practice and not being able to always stick to plans. And I hope with SCBA, we're gonna work on making practice more available to people with disabilities. That's something we're working on. So yeah, I think visiting other sanghas and seeing what they're doing is a really great way to keep your mind open to options. And the way I grew up, even though I was in a somewhat Buddhist household, there was still a very set plan for what success was. And one thing I've enjoyed about how my life's unraveled is I feel very successful and content in maybe a non-traditional path. And I want to keep doing the next skillful, wholesome choice. And I'm ready to be surprised. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so your sense of success has broadened. And you,
oh, yeah.
You think that's going to continue?
Yeah, definitely. And I, you know, success is a funny word, but I think my sense of peace and contentment has really broadened, and just the possibilities. It's a lot easier to let go of your ideas of and dreams for your life in a positive way when you see so many wide possibilities and you're inspired by so many different lives.
I agree. Wonderful. Thank you.
Eric.
Thank you very much for your talk. And I wanted to ask you, I think a couple of times I've talked with you and you've done a lot of volunteer work with animals, and I think with dogs especially. And I was wondering how your Buddhist practice maybe influenced your work with animals, and also how working with animals maybe influenced your Buddhist practice.
So when I moved to East Bay, my roommate wanted to adopt this dog. And the dog ended up not being a fit for us. But we fostered that one, and then we fostered another, and it ended up being close to 30 dogs. And I can't have pets in my current apartment. We moved, but I'll go back to it. And I loved that experience. And I loved it as a way of letting go, to really nurture and take care. And each animal would be different and have different needs. It would be a surprise. I think I was more of a big dog person before, but I found Chihuahuas to be really entertaining and sweet. And that was a great surprise. And then to send them off to loving homes and be really excited about that, because I wasn't caring for them because they were mine. I was caring for them because they needed it. And so that was a really nice expression of practice, I think. And it was practice because I had to do it over and over and keep letting go. I'd encourage anybody to try it.
Thank you. And thank you for your work with animals. I'm sure they appreciate it.
Yeah, Dave?
Yeah. Thank you for your talk, Anna. It's wonderful to hear about how your practice has grown and deepened over the years. There was one thing that you just mentioned in passing, and I wonder if you could shed some light on how this has affected that growth and deepening of your practice. You mentioned that you had experienced some other types of meditation, and I'm just wondering if you could share a little bit more about that and both what they were and how you feel that they contributed to the growth of your practice.
Sure. I've spent time with loving kindness meditation since college, and I found that to be really helpful. And then during the pandemic, I felt my sits were really restless. I think we have so much going on. I don't know if it was, you know, media or just the nature of the pandemic and everything that's happening. But my daily sitting practice became more difficult, and in a way that sometimes it felt almost harmful to keep that regular schedule. So I started supplementing with a few guided meditations. Most of my work is with SCBA, but I also do some Zoom management of other events, and I heard some, and so I decided to dabble. I thought, oh, that's nice. And before, you know, to have talking during meditation, I was very, you know, Zazen is what I've always done. But I found it helpful and supportive of the rest of my practice. So I don't even know the names of them all, but I'll do like a guided meditation on an app and just be open to that and to not see my practice as just Soto Zen and I need to keep it in this box, but to kind of open opportunities to other things that I think support the practice.
That's extremely interesting. And I think in a way, if we truly think that there's no box around our Zazen practice and it extends out into our lives and we grow from that, certainly a part of that extension would be, as you say, out into other forms of meditation, even if we always sort of come home to Zazen.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, Philip.
Thank you for your talk. I found myself curious about your how your parents said that they discouraged you from coming into the when they were sitting at the house. Is there a way in which how did they? Can you say a little, maybe a little more about how they saw you, or did they try to not proselytize, but did they try to introduce you to meditation and encourage you to do that, or did they leave you more space to find your own way?
Yeah, so both of my parents, I think, wanted us to find our own ways, my brother and myself. They're both psychologists, and so I think they had ideas about how all that would form. So I don't think it was that they didn't want me to participate in sitting, but I also think there was a sense, I don't know if that's present now, but especially back then, that Zazen and Zen was for adults and not children. And so those bases were for those adults. And I'm grateful for it in some ways, because I know that all of this was my choice. When I found the Zen writings, it all made a lot of sense to me. And I think in some ways they did raise me that way. But I felt like I was coming to it myself. With that said, I've gone to other sanghas and I've seen the Dharma schools, and I think they're really wonderful. I went to one at Clouds and Water a few months ago, and they had this big sign that said, we are kind, we take care of each other, we are safe. And I thought that was so nice to have for the children there, and a really loving environment for them to go and to be involved in the practice. So I think both ways work. But for me, I came to it later, and it was kind of hidden. The Zen books in my household were hidden away, and it was nice that I found that one.
Thank you so much. That's really interesting. Challenging for to look at the parent-child relationship in that sense.
I can say now it's really wonderful to have that in common with my dad, especially. My dad has a long history of practice, and so that's really nice to have that.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Jayshree.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Thank you for your talk. It was just been so wonderful to just watch you and see you how everything has evolved for you in this amazing way. And really, I guess, admiration for what you're doing. I guess my question is the choice to do this non-traditional path. How hard was that? And I mean, what role did your parents play in that pursuing that non-traditional path, working for a nonprofit, working for a Buddhist association, being that you are in the Bay Area, surrounded by so much of other pursuits? How did that evolve? And I think that's really amazing to see that. So
it wasn't hard. At the time that I found out about this job, I was looking for work, and a friend of mine at Berkeley Zen Center told me about it. So I was really excited to do it. I'd worked at another nonprofit, and something I really wanted to do, so it wasn't hard. And my parents were so supportive. I think because of that background, for them, this was great too. They also saw it as a dream job. There is some giving up of, you know, status and money and that stuff, but that was never really a super present goal for me. So it's been easy. And I think lots of times when you just follow what you want to do, it's pretty easy. I think when you're surrounded by people who understand what drives you, there's a lot of support in that. And, you know, who knows what the future holds, but right now it's really wonderful to be surrounded in my daily work life by people who are invested in this practice and encouraging in that way. So I support them and they support me right back through everything they're doing in their communities. It's really exciting. Exciting is a weird word in Zen, but that's how it feels sometimes.
I just wanted to briefly react to your description of the way that your parents provided this environment for you, but didn't push you in the direction of Buddhist meditation. Years ago, many, many years ago, I remember talking to a friend of mine from India. And at the time I was doing a lot of yoga. And I said, well, having grown up, myself and my friends have grown up in this Judeo-Christian tradition, we really feel great to be sort of finding our own way, using this. And it must have been wonderful growing up in India where yoga was a sort of mainstream thing. And he said, oh no, we all regard yoga as being that stuff that our parents tried to push us at. We're looking for our own thing to do.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful that your parents provided the option for you, but didn't push you into it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Travis.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same camp as Dave. I'm really fascinated with your parents, and as psychologists, you know, like, a lot of, you were saying earlier with the sanghas that you visited, that one of the Dharma schools had the sign about, you know, you're safe here. And with COVID and like people working online and the work environment is challenging right now. And so more and more people are talking about this concept of psychological safety and how you're going to be accepted wherever you are in your community, at work, at school. And so I kind of had this like idea about Zen as a kind of preschool for adults, and not as a, like, you know, a type of elementary training, but more as like the sort of fundamental work that we do that's kind of before school and before intellectual thinking. And I just wonder if, you know, you have anything to say about that. And I think given your upbringing and your time here, you're really ensconced in it. So do you have any thoughts about that?
When I came to Cannondale as a teenager and in my early 20s, it always felt like a safe place. And I think that's true. I also think if we think too much that Sangha and our practice centers are safe and like a precious jewel, that can be tricky because it's not true. They're not special in that all the same things that happen outside can't still happen there. It's still people. Mm-hmm. But we come with an intention and we come with kind of shared agreements and values. And I think that can create a special place and a feeling of safety. And what's special about it is that we all agree to continue working on it and to make it better. And we hold each other accountable and help each other in our practice. And I think in that way, it's a preschool for adults because we're all learning together and talking about what we need for our lives and what works and working on skills. And I think that's the case with many faiths, but particularly for Zen, it works well for me. It's not in a place of fear, it's in a place of, you know, freedom. Does that answer your question?
Completely, yeah. Yeah, I think, and I think that you touched on it earlier about, you know, sharing your values and having those kinds of dialogue, or, you know, it's not only is it incredibly satisfying, I think it's incredibly important because I think we long for that and we need it more than ever, you know.
Me too.
Thanks.
Yeah, Philip.
I wanted to ask, Anna, if you could say something more about this something special. I thought your point was really, really good, that there may be a tendency for every religious group to consider that what it's doing is really special, and that a certain kind of pride can creep in. I wondered if just in your work with the SDBA, if that is an issue or something that's on the agenda of the leadership. It's a subtle thing, but it seems like it must be pretty ubiquitous in a way, for everywhere. Appears or can appear everywhere.
Yeah, SCBA is a professional organization for Soto Zen Buddhist priests. And so it creates, they have peer groups so people can come together across lineages and locations. They have mentoring programs. They're currently working on updating their ethics and grievance process, which is really helpful. They do lots of trainings. We're right now conducting a survey about disability in Soto Zen practice. So in all those ways, by working together across North America, but really internationally now, it takes you out of that insular idea of the special place and holds everyone accountable in the same way we do in our sanghas, but in the wider world. And I think that's really inspiring work and is important for us all to work together in the same way that many other fields do that. For me, I think that creates a bright future for Soto Zen practice here. It's going to continue to evolve as it always has. But I think with everyone working together and sharing ideas and information, there's a lot of promise there. And I think you can have both our traditions and new ways to expand. I think sometimes when we hear about all that stuff, we worry about our lineage and our traditions, but I think it evolves with us.
Thank you. I was thinking specifically about that kind of feeling in, say, the leadership of a particular group, and it sounds like a variety of topics come up in the interaction and cooperative work among the priests and. Les mentioned humility in one of his lectures. It seems to have something to do with, at least when I started practice, there was such a elevated position that was placed on the on whoever was wearing a robe, and that also can create a sense of specialness or maybe a isolation, a sense of anyhow, I appreciate your sharing the kind of what's happening in the SDBA, and I feel too that that's an encouraging thing that these topics are being addressed. Thank you.
Amani?
It's Amani, but that's okay. A lot of people say Amani too. So this is actually just my second talk here, but I enjoyed hearing what you had to say. And I thought it was interesting that you came to the practice so young, because for me, I first started to meditate. I didn't practice Zen meditation, but a different tradition, but when I was 20. And what I found so interesting about your description is that you were looking for this like place that was calm, like this quiet kind of peace inside. And my motivation, I remember, was completely different. I was like looking for answers, and I had a very restless mind, and I was just trying to figure out like, what is all this? And, you know, I was hoping to get answers. And as somebody who I think came at it even younger and from a different angle, I'm curious, did you ever question why you were sitting, what the point was, and was that just part of, you know, you just watched it, and was there ever a point where you went more into those questions, or did they arise?
Thank you. So first, I think we're not actually that different. I wanted a sense of calm, but I was very curious, and I had that racing mind too, and I think I was hoping for answers like you too, and that would bring some calm. I don't think that I ever questioned why I was sitting or if I would stick with the practice. I hadn't thought about that very much, but no, I don't think so. I think I questioned if I was doing it right quite a bit. And one thing over time that I think we all work on, but especially in my patterns that I've noticed, is I can just be really harsh on myself and things that I would never say to someone else or think about someone else. But for me, I would know, you know, it's not that I'm not doing it right, or, you know, I know all those things intellectually, but I could be very critical with myself, and the stories that would come up in my mind were to solve those problems, you know. And that still comes here and there, but I think the longer I practice, and I'm still very young, But the longer I practice, the more used to coming back I get, and the quicker that comes of coming back and noticing, oh, that's that pattern, you know, that's that. And figuring out what to do about it and knowing when to make an adjustment. But no, I don't think I ever questioned, am I doing the right thing? It's just, it very much felt like home. I think even the aesthetics of the Zendo and all of that, it felt like a safe, like a home.
Thank you.
Thank you. David?
Thank you for your talk, Anna. I love way seeking mind talk, so I enjoyed listening to yours. I wondered if you'd elaborate on this process you've been through of visiting other practice centers. And is that within the Soto Shoes realm, or have you gone out and visited some of the other denominations of Buddhism, which are numerous and very interesting, but can cause confusion if you encounter a practice center that's doing something very differently and they believe as strongly about it as we do about what we do, that kind of thing? How have you dealt with those encounters?
Thank you. Yeah, so in high school, I visited a Tibetan monastery. Mm-hmm. I still do read a lot of books by the Dalai Lama. And that was really beautiful. It didn't feel like home to me in the same way. I've spent some practice periods at Green Gulch, well, some retreats at Green Gulch and at Tassajara. Those are in our tradition, obviously. And then with work, we travel sometimes. So I've been to centers in Oregon and in Minnesota and Iowa. I'm trying to think, I think maybe Nebraska. They're also close, the states. So those were in different lineages, but they were also Soto Zen. And it's interesting, a Ryomanji monastery in Iowa is this Japanese training monastery just out in the middle of nowhere of Iowa. And I didn't know that existed before. So just to see it, it's an inspiring thing to know that that's out there. A big part of my job is answering emails from people saying that they want to practice and they don't know where. So priests that need to go on Ango, or people that have never done Zen practice before looking for centers and there's nothing close to them. So from that, I've learned a lot about other Zen centers and who's practicing where. And it's really fun to help people connect to practice. Since the pandemic, so much of this is on Zoom, and that's created a lot of opportunity for everyone. For myself, it doesn't quite feel the same, but I know that for lots of people, it's been really wonderful. And it's also a way some people can be connected to sanghas to then go in person. So that's been exciting. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but that's some of what I've visited.
Sounds like a delightful vocation for you.
It is. Yeah, Chris.
Thank you, Anna, for your lovely talk. I was just curious about if you had any insights. I think you said your parents were both psychologists. Were you exposed to any insights or relating psychology to either Buddhism or Zen or Zazen, either for yourself or maybe for your parents' practice?
Sure. I think, I'm not a psychologist. I studied psychology in college, but I'm not one. The parallels are, they're both exploring why we do things, you know, and patterns. I think in psychology, you're making more generalities about everyone. And we could do that sometimes in our practice too. But it, you know, it's the study of ourselves. And I think when you study yourself, you learn about others. But I think sometimes we can make them the same more than they should be. And I think that that makes sense. But I do see them as separate. But I think that the interest is similar. It doesn't surprise me that a lot of Zen Buddhists are psychologists. I think that there is curiosity there. And that makes a lot of sense. And in another way, it's about freeing yourself from suffering a lot. My parents were both clinical psychologists. And so they were very interested in freeing people from suffering. Mm. So I'm sorry if I'm not expanding more, but.
That's fine. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Lee?
Hi, Anna. Thank you so much for your talk. And I just wanted to say that it's been so inspiring knowing you sort of when you were maybe a teenager and just seeing you blossom out this way and finding this path that, you know, has given you confidence and maturity. And, you know, I'm just really happy to see your life unfolding in such a wonderful way for you. So it's really been a pleasure sitting with you and knowing you. And, you know, I wanted to just express that, you know, having the opportunity to see you find your way just kind of makes me feel happy. Thank you, Anna.
You too, Lee. I think, you know, being a young person in a Sangha with mostly adults, I really felt nurtured by our Sangha, and I'm really appreciative for that, to have that steady presence, you know, while you're growing up. I think it's a really wonderful thing. And the people at Canada never made me feel like I was unwelcome because I was the young one. And I think that's a special thing. So thank you. Giuseppe?
First of all, I want to tell you that it's great that you are the contact and the face of SCPA for me, because you're very welcoming, very friendly. I just feel very nice to interact with the organization through you. I've been very struck by what you said, that you read Zen Mind, Beginner Mind when you were 11 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
My son is 11 in a few days. So my question is, what would you suggest for 11 or 12 years older to as reading, and how did you then, when and how you got introduced to sitting? Because really what I would want to know is what's your suggestion for a practice that can include younger adults?
Thank you. Oh, I think it really depends on the young adult and, you know, their life. And I think you can't put something in someone's life and know how it's going to turn out. For me, that book, I didn't totally understand it at 11 or 12. I still am not sure I totally understand it all. It changes. But it was mysterious in a good way. It sparked something in me. I think I was a really spiritual kid. Even though I wasn't raised with any religion, I really felt drawn to that. One of my favorite movies was Sister Act. I loved Whoopi Goldberg, but I also just loved the nuns. And that religion didn't fit for me, but I really craved that sense of structure for my spirituality, I guess. I think there's all kinds of ways that young people could be involved in practice. And if you're living it, I think that's the best way they can come into contact with it. SCBA did a training a while ago about families and sanghas, and they had some great ideas. There was one about making an altar in your home so that it's present. People made shoebox altars for their young kids. I thought that was a really great idea. But I think it's, you know, what sparks interest in your child and what are you hoping they'll get from sitting? Like, what is that, the desire to have your child in practice, where does that come from? And I think once you answer that question, you can figure out how to show up with it. But I think it's going to be up to them because Zen isn't easy, you know, sitting's not easy. So they're going to have their own drive to do it. And I think my parents taught me a lot of the things, a lot of the lessons of Buddhism without talking about it as if it was Buddhism. So that when it showed up, I said, oh yeah, that all makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Diane?
I was trying to unmute my picture. Thank you, Anna. For someone who's deathly afraid of public speaking, you sure fooled us. I know the feeling. I've heard that public speaking, the fear of public speaking is worse than the fear of death. Anyway, you were very articulate and very genuine, and I really appreciate your talk. It's hard to believe that you've been practicing with us for 20 years.
I do
remember when you first came, and you have grown and changed so beautifully. You've just blossomed, and I'm really impressed with your practice and all that you've done. And I'm thinking about, as everyone has, about your parents and how you discovered Zen mind, beginner's mind, on your own. That's how I came to practice, but someone suggested that I read it. It's almost as if your parents, by saying, keeping the practice kind of separate and secret and not encouraging you, it's almost as if you were enticed by it. You know, it was kind of mysterious, like, you know, the kinds of books that are just for adults. Well, we can't let the children read these. So, It's interesting, by not trying to draw you in, but rather just living the practice themselves and having the material and the practice around you, it feels like it just kind of permeated you, and you were able to discover it on your own, which is wonderful. Do you think that the fact that they didn't draw you into the practice and kept it kind of secret or separate, do you think that that made it more mysterious and interesting to you?
I'm not sure how it would have gone either way. I think because it's something that's been part of my life for so long, since middle school, but it really feels like my whole life. It just feels like a very much in me. And that's why you keep coming back of, I need to do this. I need to, you adjust how your practice shows up, but it's always going to be there. I don't think, if I questioned my practice at some point, I don't see myself ever like really leaving. I don't know if I even could do that. It's so much part of my thinking. And I don't know if it was some big mysterious thing either, but I think it was helpful because I think it was still really young to start practicing. I think your mind does need to kind of grow, and this is a practice of experience. So I think I needed to continue having experiences to have a understanding. And I think when you're really young, you don't have as many experiences as you need for that understanding. or at least it's different, you know, it feels like another lifetime, your child self. So yeah, I'm not sure how it would go, but I'm thankful for how it did. And I'm thankful that it did always feel like my choice and my thoughts and my experience. And by hearing others' experiences, that's been really inspiring too.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your practice.
I saw Teresa first, and then Cheshire.
Hi, Anna. Thank you for your talk and for the exchange during the Q&A. I wanted to ask you about something that you said tonight and something that I heard you said once, and it came to my mind as you were talking tonight. You were saying tonight how you struggled when you were a teenager with migraines. And I think that that has continued, migraines and chronic pain. Mm-hmm. And I heard you once say that Zen, your Zen practice, really help you to be creative, given these limitations of, you know, struggling with pain. But I never asked you about how it helped you to be creative, or to say a little bit more about that. So I wonder if you could do that now. Thank you.
Thank you. I think a little bit like I said in my talk, I think you can get set on the way one thing's going to be. And I still struggle with chronic illness, but not as badly as I did when I was a kid. When I was a kid, the way many of my days looked is I would wake up in the morning and I would be like throwing up and in bed until usually like 5 or 6 in the evening. And so whatever plans I made, I never really knew if they would happen or if I could follow through. And growing up as a Palo Alto kid, especially, with a lot of pressure to be successful and to have a certain life, it was really stressful because you would try to make another plan, you know, your plan B, but I didn't know if I could do my plan B either. And it created a lot of frustration and stress, which is not helpful for migraines. It just makes them worse. And all those healthy habits that you're supposed to have, they also get in the way of. So I felt stuck in my body a lot. And sitting helped me see my body as, you know, one element in experience, and to also learn that I could sit through it and to recognize what was coming up in those patterns. If I was in it, to, you know, to just know like this is this part of it, and then this is might happen. And I think that with time, you know, recognizing that everyone has that possibility every day, and I was just experiencing it more often, you figure out how are you going to be skillful. And so I can do the best I can with those days. I can be really grateful when it's over and do the best I can with the remaining part of the day. And I think when you see things clearly, when you see what's in front of you clearly, that does make you more creative. And when you're not so caught up in those stories that your mind's telling, or in your frustrating emotions, when you're not grabbing onto them, and you should still feel those things, but not sticking with them, it frees you up to see other things. And part of the reason I'm so grateful for Sangha and for my job is to see all the other ways people have done their lives. And that gives you a lot of creativity too, to see all those other examples, but without comparing yourself, you know, with having, what do they call it? Empathetic joy. I think empathetic joy is really helpful. Thank you. Jayshree.
It's, I wanted to go back to, and I do remember, I was always amazed that you would come to the Kanado and you would have these migraines and you still would sit. That was always very amazing to me to watch that, because I could see you were in pain. And but my question actually had to do with something you said a while during the talk, and this has come up. Several of us have puzzled over this, or I should say we're trying to get answers from you. And you said, because you had such a perfect kind of a situation with your parents being psychologists, being practitioners, inspiring you, but you came back and said that you were always spiritually inclined. And that seemed to be the key part of your practice and what's driven you and or what's kept you focused is your own inner sense and guidance. And so, because I know many of us puzzle over this in terms of, you know, having children or having other people we know, and, you know, we could have the same parental background, but yet each of us follow such different paths. I know in my own family, it's been like that. And I've always felt that way too, that you know, like you, have the spiritual yearning. So I was curious, is that kind of where, even though you had the perfect home environment, you seem to come back to that spiritual yearning that you have as having kept you focused and on the path of your practice? So I guess that's my question to you.
Yeah, I think you're right. I feel like if I turned away from practice, I would be denying my real truth and kind of inner voice. In the way, if you turned away from somebody you were deeply in love with for no good reason, it would just feel wrong. You know, I feel a real love for the practice and all parts of it. So it wouldn't make sense for me to turn away from it. It would feel like I was denying something really within myself and something I really see as true and wholesome. So I think that's what keeps bringing me back. It's not an intellectual thing. It's something that I really feel. Thank you. I was worried I blew through my talk too quickly, but it's almost 9. Dave, you have another question?
I just am still savoring that phrase that came up earlier, preschool for adults, our practice being preschool for adults. And for some reason, it reminds me of a conversation that we had a few years ago about what do we really mean when we say, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. I don't know what the original word, presumably in Pali, was, but refuge in English has a certain tinge of, it's a hiding place from the world. It's a sheltered hiding place. And that really isn't so much what we mean. And after talking about it for a while, we kind of concluded that really it's more like a launching pad. It's a foundation from which you can launch out into the rest of your life. And it's kind of what preschool really is, if you think about it. It's a launch pad for kids, and adults need it too. So I like that phrase, preschool for adults. I like it a lot.
Me too.
This talk was brought to you by the Kanando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to kanando.org. That's kanndo.org.